40 years ago today, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. All week, WYPR has broadcast an audio documentary about the civil unrest in Baltimore that immediately followed Dr. King's death. Tonight, in the final part of our series, we look at the current state of race relations in society and how our city has responded to the call for racial equality. WYPR's senior news analyst Fraser Smith hosts a roundtable discussion with Raymond Winbush, the director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. His latest book is The Warrior Method, a program for rearing healthy black boys. Ralph Moore, director of the Community Center at St. Francis Academy. And Peter Levy, a professor of history and political science at York College of Pennsylvania. He's the author of Civil War on Race Street, The Civil Rights Movement in Cambridge, Maryland. He's also the scholar-in-residence for the University of Baltimore special project, Baltimore 68, Riots and Rebirth. Fraser Smith begins our discussion.
Ralph, glad to have you here. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what you think the riots meant in our history, in the history of Baltimore. I mean, the conditions that changed or didn't change as a result of what happened in April of 1968?
Well, I think in terms of my recollection, I think it was a mixed bag. One of the things that I recall, and some people might differ with me, that came from the riots was that we got police helicopters. You know, we sort of went from looking down the street in the middle of the riots and seeing tanks and National Guardsmen walking up the street with bayonets to a sense that we needed to be able to have the capacity to control things like riots and rebellions better. And I think police helicopters in Baltimore came shortly thereafter, maybe a year or two or 3 years. So that was one reaction, you know, that we need to arm ourselves a little bit better. And I also recall that there was a hope and expectation in the community that more African Americans would get elected to elective office. Mm-hmm. And yet we didn't elect our first African American mayor until 1987. Dew Burns assumed the office of mayor after Don Schaefer became governor, but the first election was in 87. That was with Kurt Schmoke being elected. Even though there was some expectation that in major cities, black mayors were getting elected. I mean, my goodness, in Cleveland, Carl Stokes was elected
right.
in 67.
That's right.
And then there's Kenneth Gibson and there's Richard Hatcher and Gary, Indiana, and it's all over. There were people. And even, I guess, in Chicago, the mayor was elected.
But the city did elect a black congressman in 1970.
In 1970, that's true.
Came very close in 1968.
Right, that's true. And a state's attorney shortly thereafter
right.
and all that. So some of those expectations were met, but I think the focus was on the mayor's office and what that meant. That meant progress, I think.
Yeah, Ray Winbush.
Yeah, I think what also happened is that you, on the negative side of that, is that you started seeing a decline of the so-called urban areas. And this was not only in Baltimore, but all through the nation. And then you see Baltimore lost a huge population shift in during the 1970s. People started moving out to the
whites and blacks.
Black, exactly. Mm-hmm. The school system, and as you know, a local paper talked about the other day, the tax base shifted. So I think that was another aftermath. There's some people, and I don't agree with this, there's some people who want to attribute all manners of evils to the rebellions, that almost everything from global warming to whatever. And I don't think that happened. I think what you saw was a loss of hope among many people in the African-American community and a fear increase in the white community that decided to abandon the cities. And I think that that's something that remains with us, this kind of uneasy tension about race and Dr. King's assassination, as well as from that to Obama's possible election, that you still see this racial tension, this kind of meta, you know, communication about race that we still have in this country and still don't talk about it well.
Well, this whole issue of rising expectations, I think, in part triggered by successes in passing laws and in the civil rights movement that wasn't translated into anything that helped you in your daily life.
Exactly.
Jobs and better housing and things like that.
Yeah, and we still kind of use the buzzwords. That we know we've got affirmative action, and somebody like Rush Limbaugh says we don't, we shouldn't have it anymore and all this stuff. But I think in general, there were rising expectations, particularly, you know, as you just said, relative to elected officials. I think that Black Americans felt that Black elected officials would create what some people call transformational leadership, that they would change things. And in reality, we see that some of those things did occur, like Kenneth Gibson, Schmoke here in Baltimore, Alderman Harold Washington in Chicago. But then we also found out that many Black elected officials did everything that their white predecessors did. There was like kind of a steady state. So I think that there were probably more expectations economically and politically. Some were fulfilled and some were not.
Why do you think that Black elected officials weren't able to become the transformational leaders that some expected?
Well, some did. I mean, I was in Cleveland in high school when Carl Stokes, that's my hometown, when he clearly changed the city. I mean, no doubt about it. Ken Gibson did that up in Newark. I think that what a lot of people saw was that, you know, the Black folks started understanding that the political process was not just in who was elected mayor, but also those people, the private sector, how they supported or did not support mayors, the political process. The city councils were still, in many respects, including Baltimore, essentially white and dominated by whites. So even if you had a Black mayor, it didn't necessarily mean that there was going to be any transformation of the city at all.
I mean, I would also add that we got to see a lot of the causes of the uprisings or the riots were that the cities were already in decline.
They were. Right.
So that in one of the cities after another, when Blacks or even someone like Schaefer took over, you're in a city that's already losing jobs, losing manufacturing jobs. Mm-hmm. Crime is already increasing. Population, Black and white, is already moving out. Right. So that it's almost an impossible situation.
And the larger politics were changing. The first president to get elected after Martin Luther King's assassination was Richard M. Nixon.
And Agnew's is his vice president,
exactly.
Who symbolizes that reaction.
Right. So the larger shift was starting to happen, and cities were starting to lose favor on the national level. And so, you know, a lot of African-American mayors inherited cities with no money, no ability to transform anything because you need some bucks to be able to do that. And with people leaving the city and jobs leaving the city, there were additionally no dollars to make some changes happen.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ralph. Thurgood Marshall said that Baltimore was up south. So do you think that any change in that attitude in their city occurred as a result of the riots?
I think Baltimore has always been, and I'm not from Baltimore, but, you know, but having lived in the deep down south that Thurgood Marshall also talked about, Baltimore always makes the appearance of being a northern city because of its proximity to places like D.C. and Philly. In fact, I think that the so-called, you know, we call it charm city, but there's probably the missing adjective in that is the southern charm city because there. I don't know. I think Baltimore has always been kind of schizophrenic about what it is in terms of, is it a southern city or is it not a southern city? And I think that it's reflected in the racial attitude. The racial attitudes in Baltimore resemble very much patterns, particularly in the Deep South. And I would even say places like Mississippi in terms of the housing issue, maybe not the drug issue, but definitely how housing is and how schooling is in this city in terms of low graduation rates, which tend to characterize that report that came out a few days ago, to characterize public schools throughout the nation.
Well, that was Ray Wimbush. And Peter Levy, talk a little bit about some of what Ray was talking about there in terms of the white attitude about what happened during the riots. One of the concerns that people have had looking back is that you had a sort of a differential increase in sensibilities about race. And the images of looting and burning and crime may have turned some people who were on their way to understanding the civil rights movement around.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, we've got to be careful because there were other whites who this was an event in which they were going to galvanize and try to repair the city. There were penance marches right after the uprisings led by people who had a commitment to the city. But then if you look, I think, at Agnew as just a really symbolic figure, that he articulated and he represented the views of a lot of people, which was had been maybe somewhat understanding toward the civil rights movement in 66, 67, but this was a line they were going to draw in the sand, and law and order was what they were going to declare themselves in favor. And if anything, promoted this idea of law and order. You mentioned the idea of police helicopters, or Agnew himself later arguing that they should have shot the looters, and standing on the side against those who were making the argument that, in fact, the guard had not shot looters, and only six were killed in Baltimore, and that's six, but there had been 43 killed in Detroit the year before. It was a wise decision. And Agnew benefited politically. I mean, if he hadn't taken some brown bag money, he might have been president. And
thank you. Thank you, Peter. Ralph, you mentioned the helicopters, and we know that after the period of rioting, the drug epidemic began in the city. In some ways, it's complicated. You try to figure out you separate the forces that redefined and redefined the city. That certainly was a big one.
Oh, there's no question about it. And that's one of the forces that remains. It seems to me that in addition to helicopters and more a capacity to be able to watch people and chase people down alleys and all that kind of thing, that drugs creeped into the community. So that took a lot of people's spirit, certainly. And that was soft drugs and hard drugs. I can remember being at a lot of parties where there was a lot of this stuff being passed around, and it impacted people. It took the fight out of a lot of people. And I would say even today there's not a lot of fight in Baltimore. I remember one of the big fights not long after the riots was over Roland Patterson. He was the first African-American school superintendent, if I recall. And he was fired by the school board. And I think some of the feeling that accompanied that was that, you know, the city and its institutions still belong to whites. And so when he got the job, you know, there was tension. He was trying to push this whole concept of community schools, which was out there, not just in Baltimore, but all across the country.
That's right.
And he was trying to equalize funding better across the system. And he got rejected for whatever reasons, whether or not he was a good administrator or not. There was a big fight. There was a big hearing downtown, and the ministers were there, and the community and the school board hearing was packed. People cared, and ultimately he got thrown out on the street, the first African-American school superintendent.
So this was sort of a reassertion of white prerogatives, you think?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, I think that's what was happening, that people were not ready to let the city go. It was still Baltimore with the Baltimore Orioles and the museums and all the nice restaurants. And there's, you know, there's still some of that, I think, more subtly that exists in the city. And there still has been reluctance, I think, to turn it over to the population that most populates it.
Peter, I don't know if this is something that you looked at in your examination of what happened here, but we have been unable to identify any specific or big picture response from the federal government to what happened here, responding to the riots, or responding to the conditions that created the riots. Again, we may have this different sensibilities, and you know, if you looked at it, one of the people we talked to said if you looked at it from the white perspective, you remembered 1968 as the year of the riots and the burning that went on in the city. If you were black, you remembered it as the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated. So maybe it's not unusual that you didn't get a big federal or state response targeted solely to addressing conditions in the cities.
Well, we also need to remember the Kerner Commission report, which had basically established that it was white racism and really long-term economic and social inequality that had laid the roots for the riots in Detroit, Newark, and elsewhere, had come out just before King was assassinated. And Johnson himself already had made a determination not to make a statement in favor of that report. And he had ordered that report because he was already losing political credibility. And that was one of the problems. And there were very, very few politicians nationally who were willing to, after King was assassinated and after the rebellions there, who were willing to go back to that great society ideal, which had been Johnson's, which was creating great cities. People forget that was one of the cornerstones of the Great Society. That I think he said that, you know, great societies have great cities, and we gave up on that dream.
The contradiction to that was the sort of opposition, the sort of threat to that was the war in Vietnam. Now, there were a lot of guys from the inner city were going off to fight in Vietnam, which was costing a whole lot financially. Economically, it was just a lot, and you can't do fight poverty and fight in Southeast Asia at the same time. And so there were people who were feeling as if young black boys especially were going over to fight in the jungles of Vietnam, but life when they came back, as was the case in many wars, wasn't much better for them.
Yeah, and I think the other...
Ray Winbush.
Yeah, I think the other spinoff, like Peter Ralph said, I think that there was like within the black community idea of going to the other extreme. After King was assassinated, you see the rise of the black consciousness movement. Malcolm had been killed already, dead 3 years at that time. But you see kind of like this kind of further split that started occurring. And then the coded language started emerging. Inner city dweller then meant black. Drug dealer meant became black. And it no longer was just dealing with the mafia or, you know, or Italians or something. It was all dealing with black folk in terms of the issue of crime. So I think that you see a greater polarization. I mean, it was always there. King kind of pulled it together a little bit, and well-meaning whites remained in it. But in general, you start seeing a greater polarization in terms of discussion and all of this other stuff. And as Ralph just pointed out, you saw this affecting the national level. I don't think that Agnew, it was a coincidence by any means that Agnew got on the ticket with Nixon the same year that King was assassinated.
Where do you think it would have gone ideally? What would have happened ideally if we had an actual urban policy, which we started not having, I think, at about the same time that you're talking about, Ray?
I mean, people have speculated. I mean, we've looked at it at where I work right now at Morgan State. I mean, I think that, you know, the model cities program, all of that stuff might have been. We just don't know. We simply don't know. King clearly was trying to broaden his coalition to include poor whites with the Poor People's March that Ralph Abernathy finished. I think that you would have had a greater amount of politicization. I think blacks would have gotten more involved than they were in the transformational politics that people thought. We just don't know. We just don't know. What we see, though, is like a destruction of inner cities and trying to, you know, we used to call it urban removal rather than urban renewal, and that became the kind of the joke at that time.
Well, some of the most difficult problems that the nation faces are the ones that exist in the inner city, mm-hmm. because many people, black and white, as we've all pointed out here, left the city, and so what you have now are the most intractable kinds of problems. And it's as if we need a new strategy here. We need a new look at this. But once again, we don't have money.
What King provided black, white, and a variety of people was hope that you could really change society. And I think that what King did during the 60s was give people the idea that they can really transform the society. And I think that's what we need today. I think the politicians will follow if they feel that there's a leader that will do something like that.
Thank you, Ray Winbush. Again, Peter, drawing on your survey of all of this, have you looked at things like what happened with small business or what happened with housing in the city, things like that? Have they been improved?
Well, businesses face a tough situation. I mean, one of the kind of, you know, arcane parts of this had to do with trying to be a small businessman getting insurance after the riots, because already small businessmen had difficulty getting insurance, and the insurance rates skyrocketed. There was an attempt to create kind of a national insurance fund, but it really was inadequate. And so if you're a small businessman and you can't get insurance, that puts you in a very difficult situation. You face fire, crime was already going up. So in that sense, though I agree that the uprisings were just in the first place, they somewhat backfired in terms of small business. It became harder and harder to be a small businessman in the city. Even businesses that wanted to stay, there's this famous place called Corned Beef Row down on Lombard Street, and most people think they immediately left, and they didn't. But whites in the suburbs were more scared to come down to the area. Then there was attempted urban removal and actually worsened the situation, you know.
So there were some advances, though, in terms of where people could live, where they could shop. A lot of the old segregated city had gone away just via time. Are we seeing an example of how these problems have to be solved in a sort of evolutionary way? Are programs going to be possible to correct some of the things that linger, Ralph, do you think?
Well, I think we do need some programs. I think an emphasis ought to be made on full employment in Baltimore, for example. It's interesting that Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, well, and maybe even more so with Richard Nixon, came to the conclusion that a guaranteed income was what poor folks needed. I mean, Richard Nixon of all people. But Martin Luther King made the same call for that kind of thing. But they realized that we needed to do something for the poor stuck in the cities. And we still need that. You know, despite all the different presidents we've had, despite all the wars we've had, and that, again, is part of the problem, that we can't do big wars and war on poverty at the same time. I think we still need that, and we still, and the poor are still crying out for that.
We did have a concentrated employment program that poured, I think, billions of dollars into job training. Was it just not enough? Did it just not last long enough? I know we had generations of problems to solve.
Well, you know, there's a friend who's rather jaded about employment in the black community of mine, and he says the only time that African Americans have ever been fully employed is during slavery. And I never have entertained the idea that there's going to be 100% employment across the board in America. You know, we get used to hearing things like unemployment rate is 6%. That's a lot of people in this country who are unemployed. And the lion's share, of course, are, you know, inner city African American males. I think programs work if you have leadership that will make it work.
Gentlemen, we're nearly out of time here, and I think it would be appropriate if you would all say whatever it is on your mind that you haven't said so far about what all this means. I mean, we're talking about the riots, but we're also talking on the big picture about race relations in our country. Peter, where do you think we are?
Well, my optimism lies in that we're actually examining this, that we're looking at the anniversary of King's assassination and the uprising in Baltimore as a teachable moment to really restart a dialogue that really has not been engaged in that much by the community over the past 30 years. And you know, and everyone's really engaged. I'm very impressed by that. I'm very optimistic.
And we have a candidate for president who started it, and I think everybody else that's involved in this race has sort of picked up the theme. Okay. Ralph, where do you think we are today? We've been talking about this great cataclysm of 1968, and we're looking back to see the state of our city since then. Where do we stand?
I think, actually, when you look at today compared to 1968, there's still a lot of people stuck in poverty. The poverty rate has gone down, but the hard numbers are actually higher. We've got over 30 million people. And we're still in the middle of a couple of wars. That hasn't changed. I mean, they've changed location, but we're still in the same circumstance where we've got a war on poverty that can't be fought because we've got wars overseas. So we need to resolve some of those things, and I think people want that. I think people want some change, and I think they're looking for a new direction, and I'm hopeful that that will happen. And I think the formula that calls for people of different races and economic backgrounds working together is the same old American formula that always has produced from progress, and I think we should go back to that.
Ray Winbush, do you think there's an appetite for the kind of new war on poverty that Ralph's talking about?
I think there can be. I think it depends on a lot of things that are. I think our society really wants some kind of shift right now. It's a teachable moment, not only here locally in Baltimore, but around the country, as Peter said. And Ralph said, I think there's got to be there. People want something new. They want new politics. They want new programs that are effective. And I think that's in the air.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the final installment of our five-part series, 68, The Fire Last Time. Our series was produced by Suni Collett, Mary Rose Madden, and Fraser Smith. Special assistance was provided by Jonathan Ahrens and Lisa Morgan. The executive producer is Deborah George. 68, The Fire Last Time, was produced in part by a grant from the Maryland Humanities Council. Additional thanks to the University of Baltimore and their project, Riots and Rebirth, which is hosting a special conference on the aftermath of the King assassination throughout the weekend. 68, The Fire Last Time, can be found on our website, wypr.org. Thank you for joining us.